All good? Yeah. Kia ora, folks. How are you?
Yeah.
Kia ora. Well, nice to see you. He mihi mahi wā kia koutou. Jay Lucas aho no Kawatiri Westport. Aho ke whangaroa noho ana au nai nei. I now live in Raglan, Whangaroa. Toko Maru te waka, ko Wai Wakaiho te awa, ko Taranaki te maunga. Te ate awa te iwi, ko poki tapu te hapu, ko muru raupatu te marae no reira, tēnā koutou, tēnā tātou katoa. Nice to see you all. Thank you so much, Lloyd and Amanda, for inviting me here. I hope you have an interesting afternoon listening to me talk. Hopefully I'll be able to be more exciting than caffeine. Otherwise, you might need to get out and get a caffeine shot. But many of you in this room probably know more about the Treaty of Waitangi than me. My heart today is to try and tell you not intricate details, but tell you the story. I want to try and just give you the story, the historical perspective of how this thing came about, how this document came about. I'm 40 years old now. Oh gosh, no longer responding at the front of the altar calls for young people coming forward. So I'm just sort of getting over that. But look, I'm a pastor's kid. Sort of grew up in the church. When I was 19, I joined an organisation called Youth with a Mission. So I've been doing Christian ministry for 21 years now. For the last 5 years, I've been staff of in a church in Auckland called Edge Kingsland. And about last September the 2nd, I know the very day. But basically, we had my wife and I and our three kids sort of out of the blue felt inspired by the good Lord to shift from the city and engage more in a Māori world. So we've shifted down to Raglan, and since February I've been on a marae 2 days a week learning Te Reo Māori, so learning the language. So that's what we're currently doing. So I've been spending 2 days on the marae down there and then trying to write a book and also work as an itinerant speaker. I'm passionate about trying to communicate some of the history of the church in Aotearoa, where we've come from, and how to shape where we're going. Do you know, everybody knows what Jeremiah 29:11 says? Yeah. Well, in the Hebrew language, where it says, I know the plans I have for you, plans to give you a hope and a future, the Hebrew word for future is aharit. And what the word picture that is associated with the Hebrew understanding of that word is to sit in a rowboat, and is to row a boat. So when you're rowing a boat, where are you looking? You're looking behind you, right? So in a Hebrew context, the understanding of moving into the future is to look backwards. And it's the same in the Māori worldview. It's the same for indigenous cultures around the world. In other words, if you want to shape the context that you live in and create a future, then the way that you do that is to align yourself to the past. And by aligning yourself to the past, you look at both you have the positives in view and you have the negatives in view. If you don't hold the negatives in view, then you just repeat them in the future, right? So so a big part of my passion is to try and educate particularly the church of the story as to where we've come from. I lived in Australia for about 9 months working with Youth with a Mission over there. And I remember coming home in 2000, I think it was, and I turned on the 6 o'clock news, and lo and behold, there's something of the Treaty of Waitangi on the news. Could you imagine? You know? And I was like, oh, good night, nurse. You know, like, here we go, another thing about the bloody treaty, you know, on the news. And I remember going, oh God, could this nation move forward where this is just a part of our past and we're creating in our future? And little did I know that my sort of nonchalant prayer, really, God would take me down a journey of answering that prayer. and actually revealing to me the story of the treaty and a lot of this stuff. So my goal this afternoon is to try and story you. I hope that you're going to have a lot of questions. We'll pause in about 40 minutes or so and take a bit of a stretch, and then we'll come back for the second session, and then hopefully I'll end 15, 10 minutes before that, and we can have some Q&A time. I really want to challenge you right now to just to take a little mental photograph of what you think of the treaty. Like, with all the stuff that's in the news and all the stuff in headlines, like, what is your opinion that you'd never tell anyone else about? The gift that, there you go. There you just told us what your opinion is. We all have a worldview about what we think of this document, and we think about what's going on. And that worldview shapes your actions and your responses. So I've come here on the assumption that I'm speaking to people who adhere to the stories of Jesus. You know, and to the best of our ability, we want to align our lives to the stories of Jesus and be some sort of reflection of him in the communities of our world. So that's the premise where I'm speaking from today. And so I want to try and load you up with some of the story and some of the history, because then that will show you why our current world sees the treaty the way it does. So you're on the slides, Amanda, is that awesome? So obviously this is the document. My great-great-great-grandfather, Jorge Pokorpori, signed to Te Reti o Waitangi in August 1840 down in Wellington. He was part of the Tautiawa iwi. And so he signed the document. Somewhere his signature is on there. So I want to tell you a bit about this story. But to do that, I need to talk to you. I need to talk to you about 18th century England. So can we go to the next slide? Here's six characters I want to introduce to you by way of talking about some of the background of the treaty. Everybody's heard of John Wesley, right? John Wesley, an incredible man. What happened? Was he 5'4" or something? What, real? What, tiny, like short fellow. John Wesley was obviously the son of a preacher, and so him and his brother thought they'd follow their parents' trade and become ministers. And John Wesley was a terrible minister. He was really, really bad at what he did. To try and get good at what he did, he thought he'd become a missionary and went over to the colonies and the form, you know, before it was the United States of America, and became a missionary. On the boat ride over, he fell in love with a girl, and over there they he got engaged, but then it sort of broke off, and she got engaged with someone else, and her and her new fiance led a smear campaign against John Wesley to say that he's a terrible man. Don't trust this guy. And so his hope to try and become a better minister by going to the States backfired on him, and he tucked his tail and went back home a depressed man. But when he was on the boat going, I don't know if he was going there or going back, obviously the boat had a gnarly storm. And on board the boat was a bunch of missionaries called the Moravians. I don't know if you'd heard about the Moravians, but they were Czech Republic refugees, now based in Germany. And so he met these guys, and they were like, okay, these Moravians, they clean the decks, they clean the loos. None of the English missionaries wanted to do any of the dirty jobs. And then during the storms, these guys would huddle together and just sing worship songs to Jesus while all the English missionaries would freak out. And he's like, what's going on? There's something here that I'm missing. So when he got back to England, he went and hunted some of these guys out. And he met a guy called Peter Bowler, and Peter Bowler began to teach him and say, hey, look, John, here's the thing. You need faith in Christ. And he challenged John to preach faith until he found it. So John Wesley just made stuff up. He made it up in the pulpit. And then, of course, when you read his journals, John Wesley describes that he was in a prayer meeting one day, him and his brother, and I think even George Whitfield may have been there. But he was in a prayer meeting in the east side of London, and he describes his conversion as suddenly he found his heart strangely warmed. Strangely warmed. And all of a sudden he had the confidence that Jesus had forgiven him of his sin. And that changed everything. Now, the early 1700s, child labour was very big in England at the time. Massive poverty problems. The British government and, of course, the gentry of the societies were the industrial age was starting to develop, was developing, and the socio pattern of the poor in England was, there was a big gap between the haves and the have-nots. And with John's newly found faith happening in his heart, he began to preach. And of course, we know the story. He wasn't allowed to preach in church, so he'd preach in paddocks. And they say that after John Wesley's 50 years of ministry, they reckon that he had travelled on his horse the same distance travelling around the world 10 times. By travelling up and down England just preaching the gospel. Now, to travel around the world 10 times, we go, wow, that's amazing, and it is amazing, but the man had a terrible family life. So, yeah, Muppet, at the same time, So, everything has consequences, right? So, John Wesley is amazing, but also, on the other hand, was a terrible family man. His wife hated his guts. Anyway. Do you know the story? John fell madly in love with a woman. He loved her passionately. And then, Charles Wesley, right, the famous hymn writer, he hated that girl. And so he tricked her to not marry John. And so John and Charles, went to war. They had great tension, and so he married someone on spite. Go figure. But this is not a relationships conference, right? but John, the work that he'd done over his 50-year periods of ministry in developing the Methodist movement really did bring transformation to that society. John's ministry was really, really centered around conversion and salvation. And of course, we know he started Sunday schools. They planted medical clinics up and down England and all this sort of stuff. So the predominant thing about John was salvation. Towards the end of it, it moved into a humanitarian work and helping people out. John Wesley's last letter on his deathbed was to a guy called William Wilberforce, which is here. And have you seen the movie Amazing Grace? So obviously that's the story of William Wilberforce. But John was the first guy to actually be vocal against the slave trade. He was the first guy to go, this has to stop. And he encouraged William Wilberforce to say, William Wilberforce, you got to get behind the slave trade and stop this thing. So of course we move into the generation after Wesley of William Wilberforce and what we call the Clapham Sect. Have you heard of the Clapham Sect? An organisation of playwrights and poets and educators and politicians. These guys, they would go to church on Sunday morning and then they would go back to a guy's house called John Venn, who had a house on the Clapham Common there in London, and they would discuss England and politics and how they could transform the country. So the Clapham Sect was a group of about 25 to 30 people. And they would get together and they would just talk about how could they transform England. The group of people in the Clapham Sect became, they started Thomas Barnardo's. They influenced Thomas Barnardo's. They started Barnardo's orphanages. The Red Cross came out of them, the RSPCA came out of them, humanitarian groups all became inspired from this group of 25 people that began to bring transformation to the English society. William Wilberforce wrote a letter to a guy called Samuel Marsden and said, "Samuel Marsden, we've just started this new missionary society called the Church Missionary Society. We've partnered it, we've joined it into the Anglican movement, but hey, you should become a missionary." So William Wilberforce actually wrote to Samuel Marsden and convinced him to become a missionary with the CMS. So the Clapham Sec actually started, they started the CMS, they started another mission society as well, obviously inspired by the Baptist Missionary Society that William Carey had begun. So all this stuff began around the same time. William Wilberforce inspires Samuel Marsden. Samuel Marsden, obviously, you know, becomes a missionary, becomes that in Australia. I don't know if you know this about Samuel Marsden, but he was called the flogging parson in Australia. He was a highly disciplinary man. But his character changes when he begins to engage with Māori. He fell in love with the Māori world when he met Māori in Sydney that had gone over on whaling vessels. And of course, Samuel Marsden comes out to New Zealand, and we know in 1814, Christmas Day, Samuel Marsden's the first guy to preach the gospel here in New Zealand. Meanwhile, these guys here, Sir James Stephen and Lord Glenelg, were second generation members of the Clapham sect. So Sir James Stephen is actually William Wilberforce's nephew. So these guys are related. Now, these two guys, James Stephen and Lord Glenelg, they worked in British Parliament. They worked for the Crown. These guys had been so influenced by the Wesleyan Revival, and then towards the end of the Wesleyan Revival, we have this big humanitarian push into culture, into society. These guys took that humanitarian push into politics. And so these guys were the ones that started to go. They formed a group within the British government called the Aboriginal Protection Society. So they had noticed that English government had been trying to go into Sierra Leone, where the slave trade was based. There had been forays going into Canada. Of course, England tried to put their stamp down in the United States of America, which backfired on them. And of course, there was India that was going on. So the British Empire, the expanding British Empire, had been engaging with all of these indigenous cultures around the world. Sir James Stephen, in particular, was one of the first guys in the British government to stand up and go, "Hang on, wait, we've changed. There's people over there, it's their place." And Sir James Stephens was one of the first guys to propose the idea of the Treaty of Waitangi. Sir James Stephen, along with a guy called Dandison Coates, who was the lay secretary for the CMS, for the Church Missionary Society, who Samuel Marsden was working for, were getting correspondence back and forth from New Zealand to England and seeing what was happening in there. And so these guys were the first guys, Glenelg and Stephens, to go, "Actually, you know what? Maybe it's a good idea that we try and to enter into an agreement with the indigenous people down there in England. Something that the English government at that time hadn't done up to that point. Let's actually enter into a treaty with the local people." Meanwhile, this guy here, is anybody related to the Wakefields? Just checking. Totally fine if you are. This is Arthur Gibbon Wakefield, founder of New Zealand. Arthur Gibbon Wakefield ran off with a politician's in England, 16-year-old daughter, and they eloped to France. They basically got caught up with him eventually, and they put him in prison. While he was in prison, he studied economics. And when he was in prison, he studied economics. And when he was set free, he was like, okay, he tried to put his new economic theory to plan. What his plan was is that the slums of London that were filled with, or not just London, but all around England, that were filled with the poor, how could we give the poor land? Ah, I know. There's Canada. There's America. Oh, hang on, we can't go there anymore. But there's Canada and there's New Zealand. Let's get land really, really cheap over there and give the poor people in England, give them land so they go over there. That leaves more land for us here in England that we can control and we can develop financially over here. So that was his economic theory. So before he even owned land in New Zealand, he got businessmen on board on his favour in England and actually advertised for the selling of land in New Zealand before he'd even bought any. And so you're and my ancestors, one of my ancestors was the first to come out on the boat with his brother in 1840, came out to New Zealand with the promise that they had land before they even had land. So Arthur Gibbon Wakefield and his brother, sorry, I forget his brother's name. Oh, Edward and Arthur was his brother. So these guys come in and they start a thing called the New Zealand Company. Now, the New Zealand Company, what they're trying to do is at the same time James Stephen is working in the government on one angle, Arthur Gibbon is lobbying the British Crown to say, give us New Zealand. Let us be the colonising mechanism by which the British government moves into New Zealand. James Stephen is going, no, you can't do that. We've had this massive revival that's brought this whole humanitarian thing. You know, child labour has stopped. All this stuff's happening. This mentality has now shifted into the British Crown, and James Stephen is going, hang on, there's a people down in New Zealand. It's their place. It's not our place. If we're going to go down there, we're going to enter into some form of an agreement with the tribes down there and the people down there. And Arthur Gibbon Wakefield is going, no, 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 no. So even after the treaty was signed, Arthur and Edward Wakefield were kept telling the British society and even the settlers down in New Zealand that the treaty was a fraud because they just wanted to buy and sell land as quickly as they could. That's some of the context of what was going on in England. Enter the next slide. Enter these guys, Henry Williams and Governor Hobson. Henry Williams, of course, the missions in New Zealand really changed when he came up. When Samuel Marsden came here, Samuel Marsden believed that Māori couldn't receive the gospel unless they became British. So they needed to become civilised. So they needed to eat like the English, they needed to dress like the English, and then talk the English language. And once that happened, then Māori could receive the gospel. That was just the mentality of missions at that day. Henry Wakefield was like, whoa, we got this backwards. We need to get into the Māori world. We need to learn language. So Henry and then his brother William, they really worked at language translation. And William Williams was this guy's brother was the first guy to get the first Bible, indigenous Bible in the Southern Hemisphere. It was printed here in New Zealand. Pretty amazing story, really. So Henry really flipped it on its head. There was two Māori dudes were in Otaki. Have you heard of Taropraha? Right? Taropraha's son became Christian, and they'd heard there were missionaries in the Bay of Islands. So he rocks up to the Bay of Islands, asks for a missionary to Henry Williams, and a guy from England had just showed up called Octavius Hadfield. Octavius was 23 years old, and he's like, oh man, I'm going to die anyway, because he was a severe asthmatic, so he's like, send me. So Henry Williams is like, oh, okay. So Henry Williams, Octavius, and Tamihana Taropraha and his cousin, Martini Te Fifi, they get on a boat from Bay of Islands and they sail back down to Waikanae to drop Octavius off. Meanwhile, they get to just off Kapiti Island and they blow, a storm comes and they blow them over to South Island, where they go and they see that the New Zealand Company has already been there. And for a few blankets and a few guns, they had purchased the Golden Bay, almost a line from the Golden Bay across to Kaikoura. Like the New Zealand company had tried to buy, had bought up, apparently bought all this land. They come back to, and Henry Williams is like, what? How did this happen? Tell me about that agreement. So Henry Williams is trying to catch up with the New Zealand company to grab them across the knuckles to say, guys, you're being mischievous here, and you can't do this. What's more, you don't know anything about the Māori mind. You've just come here from England thinking that you could purchase land off an individual. And so he gets to Wellington and he sees what's been happening in Wellington, what's been bought in Wellington. He eventually hears what's going on up at the southern point of Taranaki as well, where the New Zealand company had, quote-unquote, purchased all this land. Meanwhile, Henry Williams is fuming about what the New Zealand company is going on and what they're doing. Henry doesn't catch up with them, but Henry walks from Wellington to Whanganui to Taupō to Matamata to Auckland to Bay of Islands. It takes him 3 months. When he gets back to the Bay of Islands 2 weeks later, Governor Hobson shows up. And during this whole time, Governor Hobson had been instructed by the British Crown to go down to New Zealand and to enter into a treaty agreement that hadn't been drafted, but the ideas had been given to him by Sir James Stephen, the second member of the Clapham sect. So Hobson shows up down there, and Henry Williams had just seen what the New Zealand company was going on and what was happening. That his countrymen were acting out of control. What's more, the French were colonising the South Pacific. The French wanted to annex New Zealand as well. So there's a little bit of jostling going on here. But Henry Williams, more than anyone, he was an ex-naval officer. He had actually been fighting in America, actually, for the British Navy. But more than anyone, Henry Williams knew the British government, politics, but knew what was happening on the land. Do you know modern-day Russell? You know, where Russell is. So the Māori name is Kororareka. And remember Charles, do you know who Charles Darwin is? Charles Darwin comes down and he visits Kororareka. He visits Russell and he calls it, Charles Darwin calls it, the hellhole of the South Pacific. There are 1,000 ships coming to New Zealand a year. Now, if you take the average of 30 sailors being on a ship, 30,000 men, sea leg, what do they want? They want women. They've got their rum. They trade it. And so New Zealand got a bit of a reputation of that parts of Northland were like a brothel. So you've got this thing of Māori are going to the missionaries. Well, look at these guys. Like, you know, what's up with that? So you've got this trade, you've got this brothel, you've got the New Zealand company, you've got the French, you've got this milieu of globalization that's reaching the shores of Aotearoa. And in the middle of that milieu is Henry Williams and the missionaries. They understand and they are sensing what's going on. And what is happening. Whether Māori liked it or understood it or not, which I know some did because some began to travel abroad, the globe was here and the globe was coming and was only going to keep company. And with the promise that the New Zealand company was actually bringing settlers over and were beginning to bring them in a big rate, the missionaries were like, okay, I think it's a good thing that somehow the British Crown, for the first time, enter into a partnership with the Indigenous people. So Hobson comes down and gives Henry Williams the treaty that he had drafted, him and his secretary had drafted on the boat while they came over here. He gives it to... So Henry and his son, they handed it on the 4th of February, 1840. That night, And one night, Henry Williams and his son Edward stay up all night and translate the treaty from the English that they had been given to them into Māori. The next day, on the 5th of April, they discuss it. That night, the chiefs discuss it with the missionaries. And of course, we know on the 6th of February, they began to sign it. What's the next slide you got there? On the 6th of February, it's signed. And then the next slide. So this is Honeheke. Remember the guy that chopped down the flagpole? Right. So this is him. He was 32 at the time, so he was young, which is very unusual for someone that young to be given the state of a rangatira, of a leader. But Honeheke stands up and says, this is what he says, it's not for us, but for you, our fathers, you missionaries. It is for you to say, to decide what it shall be. And this was the sentiment of the chiefs who signed the treaty at that time. Is what we don't. Is this good for us? Was it not good for us? Like all their trust went to the missionaries. Now, over the year of 1840, there were 9 treaty ships that went around the country that, you know, we have 500 signatures on those treaty ships. They all went around the country and they were all taken around by missionaries. The only treaty sheet that wasn't taken by a missionary was the Whakatane sheet, which was taken by a businessman who was an ex-missionary. So he'd left being a missionary and become a businessman, and he said to the tribes over there in Whakatane, hey man, sign this, I'll give you some blankets. I'll give you some stuff. Sure, bro. You know, but this is the important thing. Within the only reason there is a treaty, and the only reason it is respected, is because there were concerned Christians working in the British government, listening to the missionaries on board who were, you know, on board here in the land, that were like, this thing's got to be entered into. And it was the first time the British government was forced, in a way, because of the big move of God that had happened in that country, the psychology of being sort of that God was present, that actually forced them to enter into this agreement and not just go in there and take it over. Now, at the time of 1840, there were 2,000 Europeans actually living in the country at the time. They reckon they estimate the population of Māori to be 200,000. So if there was any sort of understanding that this treaty was a shafty, trickery, one-upmanship trying to take their land, the British would have got wasted. It would have been that simple. But it wasn't that at all. It was the hope of entering into an agreement and into a partnership together down here. So this is why they signed it. The next slide is... So... this is what the treaty says. Her Majesty the Queen of England confirms and guarantees to the chiefs and tribes of New Zealand, to the respective families and individuals thereof, the full, exclusive and undeserved possession of their lands and estates, forest, fisheries and other properties, which they may collectively, which is a big, big definition, collectively or individually possess, so long as it is their wish and desire to retain the same in their possession. So this was not about giving over land. The treaty wasn't about giving land to the British or to the British Crown. The treaty was about entering into an agreement on how do we govern together in this land that is Māori. Do you understand what I'm saying? So this is what the treaty promised. So the next slide. So the top, the red represents the land that was in Māori ownership. So in 1860, so 20 years after the signing of the treaty, 1890, 1910, and 99, 100 years after the signing of treaty, the bottom right is the land that was now left in Māori ownership after an agreement that was signed. What's the next slide? Oh. In 1860, the entire South Island was gone. All of it. had been taken by the crown. Just after 20 years. The sentiment, mission started here like 1814. For 20 years, there's two converts. One of those converts was because a lady wanted to marry a missionary in Tauranga, so she had to become converted. Between 1835 and 1845, all of that changed. Missionary George Clark, in his journal in 1845, estimated 65,000 Māori attending church on a Sunday, out of an estimated population of 90 to 120,000 at that time. So you do the math. There's a term in religious circles called revival. Now I don't know any revival in history where the majority of the people were so influenced by the stories of Jesus. And the reason they were influenced by that was when Henry Williams and William Williams came in and they put the scripture into the Māori language and Māori began to read the stories for themselves. They're like, oh, this is what these guys have been talking about. Oh, this guy's amazing. Why was Jesus amazing? Jesus was amazing because Hongihika, a Ngāpuhi tribe, had been given muskets and had gone through the North Island blowing tribes away. So there had been death and there had been slaughter. And here's this message of this new Atua, this new God, that talks about turning the other cheek and giving forgiveness instead of taking revenge. Like the whole thing, the gospel scratched an itch within Māori society at the period of the late 1830s. And Māori came in droves. The only reason cannibalism stopped in a major way is because of the gospel. The history books say it's because of trade. Is that a factor? Yes, it is. Cannibalism doesn't do good if you want to trade in new technology, right? Doesn't look good on paper. But the thing that changed the heart was the stories of Jesus. Incredible. Around that time in 1845, it's the same year that Honeheke cut down the flagpole. These guys cut down the flagpole because the crown that was given permission to come and start governing began to take land. And Māori were like, well, hang on, what's going on there? And then we have the period of New Zealand from 1850 to late 1880s, early 1890s, called the Land Wars, where you see, we saw it in those maps, you see this massive confiscation period happen from 1890 and onwards. It's the period in the history called the Land Wars. Now, the general gist of Māori were going to missionaries at the time. Hey, missionaries, whose side are you on? You've been with us for 30 years. You know, the church was 100% Māori, if that makes sense. You know, like they go, well, you know, whose side are you on? What's going on here? Meanwhile, the settlers and the politicians were going to the missionaries, oh, well, hey, whose side are you on? There's a rouse. You're European. You're one of us. And by and large, it got, and the church started to do Christianity and just for the settlers. And so Māori were like, and walked out. Just like that. Octavius Hadfield, the missionary that went to Otaki, Henry Williams, William Williams, these guys were going to the crown and the church. This is wrong. You can't do this. And Bishop Selwyn, the head of the Anglican Church in the 1850s, 60s, was like, nah, we're going to support the crown. We're going to get the church to support what the British government is doing. And so Māori considered that the great betrayal of the church. And you're a part of it. So am I. This is how this story plays out. I've been sitting at the front of a church on stairs like this, talking with a 14-year-old girl. And I ask her, have you ever thought about being a Christian? And she goes, oh, I can't, I'm Māori. I can't be a Christian and be Māori at the same time. And I'm like, who told you that? This story told her that. This story, handed down, tells her that Christianity is the antithesis of being Māori. And it's completely not true. When our ancestors received the gospel in a phenomenal way, like no other people in the world had at the time, it was phenomenal. They reckon that the East Coast, Ngāti Porou, was one of the first cases missionaries had never seen indigenous people led to faith by their own people before even any missionaries showed up. When missionaries first got to the East Coast in 1839, they showed up to Ngāti Porou already honouring the Sabbath, already singing worship songs, and having portions of scripture. They were like, where did this come from? It all came from ex-slaves that got released and went home and began to tell the people about Jesus. It was absolutely unbelievable. Here's the thing about the treaty. The church in New Zealand sides with the dominant cultural view of New Zealand. This is important. As New Zealanders, we just side with the public consensus. So when we are confronted with news pieces and headlines and those bloody Maoris doing the thing again, we actually spiritually have shared in that sentiment. And the reason we've shared in that sentiment is because we've lost the story. We've actually forgotten the story. That the whole reason that argument is there in the first place is because our spiritual ancestors stood in the place where we now stand and said, you know what, this place, Aotearoa, it belongs to a people and we're here to serve them. So British Crown, you can't just come in and do what you do here like you've tried to do in Sierra Leone, like you tried to do in India, like you tried to do in Canada, like you tried to do in the United States. You can't do that. It was the voice of missionaries in the church in those early days is the very reason we have the treaty in the first place. And predominantly the church has forgotten that. And we've lost it. So when we find ourselves siding with the sentiment of dominant New Zealand that just doesn't understand this treaty negotiation and stuff like that, we're actually, I call it poo-wooing. Like we're poo-wooing our own story. Like we're dishonouring our own Christian heritage because we don't know it. Make sense? Okay, let's take a little stretch and we'll come back. And afterwards, I want to show you why Māori basically hate you. No, that's a bit strong. No. Go to the next one. Does anybody know what that is? Okay, cool. Awesome. So I want to give you the crux of the problem. Like, what is the problem of the treaty really all about? And it's about interpretation. What do words mean? What does words mean and what does history mean? And I want to give you a big part of the reason why this young girl I talked to you about, why as Māori she can't be Christian and what many Māori leaders have been trained to believe about you and I and the story of Jesus. So here's the glossary that you need. So the term mana. So mana is prestige, authority. It's your influence, it's the personal power that you possess. Mana is very sacred, very represented by the head, which is why the head is tapu, which is why in battle, if you could bite that bit of flesh, I could take all of your mana. Woo! So that would often happen in warfare. Just a little side note. The term kawanatanga, okay? Kawanatanga means government, dominion, rule, authority, governorship, province. Tino rangatiratanga, self-determination, sovereignty, domination, rule, control, power. Now, here's what you need to know about kawanatanga and tino rangatiratanga. Like, when I say the word tino rangatiratanga, what do you picture in your mind? Anybody want to be honest? Come on. Flag.
Yeah.
What, anything else? Sovereignty? Māori sovereignty? Okay, these terms are made-up terms. And they're made up by interpreting the Bible. They are terms that came into place to try and interpret the Bible into Māori language. Kawanatanga, the only time kawanatanga was used was to describe who Pontius Pilate was and what Pontius Pilate did as the governor of Judea. So it was a word, so kawa is like sort of rule and law. So kawanatanga is the one that puts the rules over the people and helps set the rules. So it was a made-up word to describe what Pontius Pilate did, how he was a Roman but worked in Israel and had to set rules for both the Jews and the Romans and everyone else. So he was the kawanatanga over that area. Rangatiratanga, or tino, like tino pai, very good. Tino means your rangatiratanga is like leadership, chieftainship, all this, but your absolute chieftainship. It was a term used to describe the kingdom of God. That this is what the kingdom of God was, the tino rangatiratanga. It was a term made in the Bible used to describe the status of what the kingdom of God was, a rangatiratanga. So that's where that term comes from. Kawanatanga wasn't used in the vocab of Māori and before the Bible. Rangatiratanga kind of was, but made popular by the Bible to describe the kingdom of God. So this is pretty important information for you to know. So next slide, please. Oh, lovely. This is Ruth Ross. She was an amazing linguist and academic. Actually, she might even be from Waiuku. Maybe, actually. Anyway. Go and Google that after. Google it now, hey! Ruth Ross was she was a linguist. She was a part of Victoria University, and then she became a housewife. And in 1972, she presented a paper at Victoria University in Wellington that shifted the landscape of the treaty and how the treaty is. Portrayed in New Zealand. She did two things in the paper that one is phenomenal, and as a Christian, the second thing is terrible. The first thing was that in 1972, so think about this, so the treaty was in 1840, so politics and government had happened since 1840, but it wasn't until 1972 that Ruth Ross was the first one to stand up in the public and go, hang on a second, Māori signed the Māori version, not the English version. The English version can say whatever it says, but the one that was signed was the Māori version of Te Tiriti. So the real treaty is the one that was signed, which is the Māori version. So there's 500 signatures on the Māori version, 32, I think, on the English one, which was signed at Port Waikato here. And that's one because they waited for like a day or two for the Māori version to show up, but it didn't show up. So they ended up just, the chiefs at Port Waikato signed the English version, saying, oh, we'll sign the Māori one later. But she was the first one to stand up and actually say that, and everyone's like, oh, of course, well, that makes sense. So that's where it came into play for the first time within the government realm, that actually the when it comes to talking about the treaty, the one we need to take seriously is the version that Māori actually signed. So big thing to say. And then the next thing, what's the next slide? Sorry. The next thing that she'd done was that I want to give you her argument that she brought in 1972. You can go and download her paper. It's called Text and Translations, so you can read it for yourself. But this is what she did. In 1835, Henry Williams wrote the Declaration of Independence for the United Tribes of Aotearoa. So you know how so Māori were beginning to go off in ships, and people in New Zealand were beginning to go off in ships over to Sydney, but they weren't allowed to sell their goods because they didn't have a flag. It was just a rule. You needed to be a bona fide nation to be able to trade in the global thing. So in 1835, Sir James Busby, or James Busby, the British resident, and Henry Williams, they got together and they wrote the Declaration of Independence for the United Tribes of Aotearoa. In that declaration, it was an announcement to the world that Aotearoa is a full bona fide sovereign nation governed by the United Tribes, by the United Chiefs in Aotearoa. They did this document, they had it signed by chiefs, and they created the first flag. You know the United Tribes of Aotearoa flag, the white one with the red cross and the four stars? I love that flag. Anyway, so that's how that flag was created and came into being. Now, in the English and in the Māori translation, the word sovereign, Henry Williams translated sovereign in the Declaration of Independence to be mana in 1835. So in 1835, he takes the word sovereign and he uses the term mana. So remember, mana means chieftainship, authority, power, prestige. In other words, the Declaration of Independence was about Māori exercising our chieftainship over the whenua and the motu of Aotearoa. This is our space. 5 years later, when it came to the signing of Te Tiriti, the Treaty of Waitangi, Henry Williams, for the word sovereignty, puts the word kawanatanga. 1972, Ruth Ross stands up and goes, "Hang on a second! What's going on here? What were these sneaky little missionaries trying to do?" And Ruth Ross puts forward her paper, and she puts forward the argument that Henry Williams deceitfully tricked Māori. That he was being a duplicitous man trying to get the tribes and the chiefs to sign this agreement so the Crown could come in and take their version of sovereignty on this space. And she was like, "Hang on a sec, these words are different." And he's used them in one word in one time, and then 5 years later he used a completely different word. What's going on here? And she came up with a lovely interpretation, and I want to tell you about that interpretation. What's the next slide there, Amanda? This is what she writes in her paper. She says, "The language of the Treaty of Waitangi is not indigenous Māori. It is missionary Māori, specifically Protestant missionary Māori. It was not the New Zealanders who called this unknown thing kawanatanga. It was the Protestant missionaries. It is difficult to conclude that the omission of mana from the text of the Treaty of Waitangi was no accidental oversight. Is not this woolly-mindedness the real crux of the Waitangi problem?" 1972, she stands up at Victoria University and espouses this essay, and it scratches an itch. The New Zealand wool board crisis had just gone through in the late 1960s. A lot of Māori who had taken, over the 30, 40 years, shifting from land into the cities, working in that industry, lost their jobs, all this sort of stuff. So in 1970, it's like lighting fire to a... Someone finished fire to a... lighting a match. Gas. Yeah, let's play with that one. Gas. Yeah. It just went voof. And all of a sudden, there was someone to blame. It's like, yeah. Those bloody Christians. Missionaries. This is what she presented. And she's saying that Henry Williams intentionally didn't put the word mana there for sovereignty, because she argues if Henry Williams had to put mana there, there's no way the chiefs would have signed it. There's no way. Because it is impossible in the Māori world to sign away your mana. You can't. You just can't do that. And so she puts forth the argument that he was wrong. Now, this is what another lecturer has said about Ruth Ross. Ross, characteristically perhaps, was skeptical of the universal beneficence of early missionaries. Ross found that Williams' attitude towards Māori to have been at best paternalistic and at worst condescending. She maintained that as a document, it was based on an element of deceit. And this is why you and I have been brought up in this country without any recollection in our history books at all to the missionaries. You go through high school, you look at all the texts in high school, you go to universities, you look at the textbooks on history there, there's hardly anything about the missionaries. If there is, it tells this story. This is the story that, particularly for the last 50 years, has been told in all of our academic institutions in the country. This is why the term missionary in New Zealand history is a bad word and is a bad term. And Ruth Ross puts forth this argument to say this. Henry Williams, this is what he says, this, the Treaty of Waitangi have been declared as the origin of the existing mischief by which the chiefs have given up their rank, rights and privileges as chiefs with their lands and all their positions. To meet this growing evil, I had 400 copies of the Waitangi Treaty struck off, printed off and distributed. For many days was engaged in explaining the same, showing the chiefs that this treaty was indeed their Magna Carta, whereby their lands, their rights and privileges were secured to them. Now the Magna Carta in the 13th century, is it, the 1200s? You know, basically the people, well, the rich people, stood up to the king and said, hey man, you're just one of us, bro. You know, this is our land, you know, so you need to adhere to the rules that we set, pal. You know, so this was Henry Williams believed that the treaty was the Māori's version of this, basically saying to the queen, you're one of us. You can come and you've got some authority to exercise, but you're going to do it with us and in relationship with us. So here's the deal. In 1972, this is the argument that Ruth Ross puts out, and it's the argument that catches. And it's the argument that sets the tone and the sentiment of education around Te Tiriti o Waitangi that the missionaries involved in. So this is the tone that is out there. And in the Māori academic world, this is the internal belief system around missionaries and therefore anything to do with Christianity. Is that Christianity equals colonialism because of this. Now, they've got fair reasons when you study colonialism. The church has been, you know, I mean, the king and queen of Spain, right? They wrote an edict, yes, Christopher Columbus, go to the Americas and take that sucker in the name of Jesus and do whatever you need to do to do it. You know, they wrote a document to giving Christopher Columbus permission to go and do that. So the history of colonialism has been married to the Christian story. Yet the Christianity hasn't been aware of that. We haven't been aware that as we've propagated our understanding of the Christian faith, we've subversively to certain types of society, without us knowing it, actually propagated colonialism. But we haven't known that. So Henry Williams, Ruth Ross puts this interpretation on this guy's life. And now as a linguist, as a study of language and cultures, her goal, you know, her expertise says to look at the know, look at the context of words. Look at them and see what's going on. And she did that really well. She looked at the words and she discovered something. But then she put her interpretation on those words, which is the very thing that in her field of study, she is supposed to be careful of to what she does. But we are interpreters. We have to interpret culture. We can't help but interpret all things. So we have to do that. So she did, and her spin on it was that the mission, that Henry Williams was being deceitful, that he was tricking Māori into signing the treaty, and therefore giving the crown the rights to take the land and all this sort of stuff. But the problem with this situation is that it doesn't line up with anything in the history books about who Henry Williams was, to what he believed, to what he what he wrote and why he believed in the treaty. He was the only guy out of anyone in the world that was aware of what his own countrymen were doing in the New Zealand Company. He was aware on the coalface of what was going on. He was aware with what the Catholics and the French were trying to do and also trying to annex New Zealand. He was aware of the global milieu that was happening. He was aware of what was happening to Māori with disease and with his countrymen that were coming down and the whalers and the settlers and all this sort of stuff. The world was getting smaller, and his heart was to try and how could he help Māori enter into a level playing field with this globalizing world. He knew that there's no way, it's impossible for Māori to sign away money. He had been involved in the Declaration of Independence that was to him about Māori saying, now this is our bona fide nation here. What's going on with the treaty was another nation was going to enter in and they were going to do a governorship in their land together. This is within the Māori mind, within Henry Williams' understanding, this is what was going on. And when Henry Williams began to challenge the crown on what they were doing, they ran a smear campaign against him. And that's why he had 400 copies struck off. Because there's a guy called Governor Grey. You know Governor Grey? You know, built Great South Road here? So he built the road come down from Auckland to come and blow away Māori finding me down the road here. Pew, pew, you know. But anyway, he was... He was really not a nice man, really. Clever, smart, intelligent, but quite deceitful, very deceitful man. But he ran a smear campaign against Henry Williams. And he challenged Henry Williams. He said, how can you talk about land here and the crown not taking the land? You yourself have taken land. See, look at your 11,000 acres that you bought off Māori. You're just as worse as us. And he actually had Henry Williams struck off the CMS Missionary Society. Henry Williams got struck off because he told them this whole story that Henry Williams himself was taking land. Henry Williams brought 11,000 acres for his family off Ngāpuhi, but he paid for 22,000 acres. He doubled the price and gave it. Henry Williams goes through the smear campaign, and it wasn't until 1852 when his brother William Williams went back to London and told the real story that they reinstated him. But by this time, Henry Williams was a really, really sad, broken man. They were his last words. They were his last words. How cruel, how cruel. So what the British government had done to him and to Māori and New Zealand. So Ruth Ross makes this argument that doesn't match with anything else in any other recorded part of history that Henry Williams was all about trying to trick Māori. It's simply not true. But that sentiment has been put forward into the belief system of academic Māori for the last 40 years. Okay? Dr. Ranganui Walker, you know, he passed away recently. This is what he writes. In 1814, the missionaries arrived bearing the cross in one hand and the Bible in the other as justification for their mission of converting the Māori from heathenism to Christianity and savagery to civilization. This glorified mission masked the insidious nature of their cultural invasion. They railed against the sacred icons of the Māori as works of the devil, and systematically undermined their myths and spiritual beliefs to replace them with their own. This is his beliefs. The next slide, on Ruth Ross, the most penetrating critique in recent times of the events surrounding the drafting and signing of the treaty. So he was a student of Ruth Ross. Moana Jackson was a student of Ruth Ross. And all these other Māori academics, they are phenomenal people, and we need to listen to their challenges and their critique, because he's also right. He's correct, but he's also misinformed. Remember the last World Cup? Remember each game opening with the pukaia, the Māori trumpet? Had you ever seen one of those before? No, someone had. Most people had never seen the Māori trumpet before. And the reason we didn't see the Māori trumpet is because the missionaries burned them. Got rid of all those Māori instruments. And said no, because they were used to worship Atua, other gods, and so the missionaries got rid of them. And they've only come back into the psychology of Māori since the 1980s. Anyway, that's another story. But that's what's going on, right? So all of these incredible Māori academics have been trained with this belief and the sentiment of Ruth Ross. No one would question that most of the early missionaries, Protestant and Catholic, were sincere men doing the best for the New Zealanders, often under very tiring conditions. But what we must recognise is that their best was not always very good, their actions were not always wise, their teaching was not always in the best interest of those they taught. In one area, she's true, but in her argument, she's wrong. Henry Williams was not a duplicitous man. He... Perfect timing, eh? Like this, awesome. His heart was for Māori. His heart was that this document and this thing was about, for the first time in British history, actually entering into an agreement with an Indigenous people that there would be a genuine, bona fide partnership. And it's from my perspective, it's the only reason that this document is in our psyche 175 years later is because of the work of the missionaries and the work of the Holy Spirit that is on that thing. It's the work of our ancestors, our spiritual ancestors, guys. They stood and they believed for something to happen down here at the ends of the world that would be a genuine partnership, that there would be righteousness, right? Real relationship. Genuine relationship. And I think the only reason it's there is because there's something of the Spirit of God that's still hovering away, not letting New Zealand get past it until this thing becomes something that we all champion. Now, we got 25 years to the 200th anniversary of the treaty. Here's the goal, guys. We need to get our country to that place in 25 years' time where we all get to that anniversary and we go, Treaty of Waitangi, yeah! Where we go, yes, because we've gone through the process of grievance. We've gone through that. And we've come to a phase of where, as a nation, we are beginning to create with a Western mindset and an Indigenous mindset in partnership doing life together. That sounds like Jesus to me. That sounds like something that the Holy Spirit would want to do in our land. Nō reira, tēnā koutou, tēnā tātou katoa. Kia ora pāna, that's my little talk. So, before I sit down, we've got 10 minutes of Q&A, so... Does anybody want to ask anything? Does anyone need any clarity? Yeah, sir. Man, we are. This thing's happening whether we like it or not, or know it or not. You know, I mean, a couple of things. As far as how to move forward, it's education. It really is education. We've got to tell the story. Have you noticed the last 5 years in when you turn on the telly and there's adverts, there's so many stories that are in adverts now? They're not just going product, 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 but they've got families and they're trying to tell stories. In other words, culture has caught on that the way you sell information is by telling a narrative. You've got to tell a story. So what is happening right now is that, see, all New Zealanders fed is, the Treaty of Waitangi, Treaty of Waitangi, gravy train, what, this. And it's fitting a narrative that's come from somewhere, but we don't know where that's come from. And unfortunately, it's come from a part of the story that's just not telling the truth. So the goal right now, I've been telling people for the last 5 years, is we've got to educate ourselves. I think in September the 2nd, 2008, you know, one of the strengths of the national government, from my perspective, is that they said, every treaty claim has to be in that day. So right now in the history of Aotearoa, all the treaty claims are in. It's going to take us another 30 years to process them, but they're all in. But that actually signifies an end point where you can actually, you have to end, you actually go. And there's a great Māori lecturer. I wouldn't call him a Christian, but he knows the Christian understanding very well. He says that Māori are in a season of moving from grievance to creativity. And that is the season we're in. The generations now, I think we're in a demarcation point where the grievance period is over and we're moving into creativity. Okay, what does Indigenous creativity look like? More, what does it look like in partnership with the Western understanding of the world? So I think, yeah, this is... So for our goal should be getting our grandkids and our kids to the point where they become leaders in society and they know how to move in an Indigenous worldview. Right now, we have to learn it. I haven't been brought up Māori at all. You know, my father, who's 74, was, you know, his generation threw out everything about Māori stuff because it wasn't cool. Didn't help, you know. So I'm of that generation that's having to really relearn stuff. So for me, the period of the 1970s is the period called the Māori Renaissance. In that period, you have Bastion Point, you have the Raglan Land March, the golf course thing, you have the treaty, the Waitangi Tribunal brought into existence in 1975. So that signified, in our history, that is actually where, that's when the change started. What I'm communicating to you is a change that started 40 years ago. We're only catching up to that, what's actually going on now. So I believe with all my heart, yeah, this is going to happen. I think it's our goal, and I believe as ministers of the gospel, right, in the church, we are an organisation of people that are supposed to exist for everybody else except ourselves, right? We exist for not just Christians, we exist to be priests on behalf of the nation. On behalf of society, our job is to tell the nation who they are. You are, whether you follow Jesus or not, that doesn't matter. This is who you are. And what that means for us as ministers and priests is that it's our job to tell the nation, this is who you are in your bicultural identity. This is who you are. Māori and Pākehā moving forward together. That makes sense. Sorry, there's a question down here. Oh, someone's passing the mic.
When you said about the slaves that came, the Māori slaves that came back to the Ngāti Porou and brought Christianity, where were they slaves from and how were they set free?
Hongi Hika, who's a Ngāpuhi tribe, he met King George in 1820. 18, sorry. When he came, King George V gave him a whole bunch of gifts, came back when he went to Sydney, he traded all those gifts in for muskets. Came back and just started blowing tribes away. Went all the way Ngāti Porou, Tainui, went all the way down. Just took slaves back up to Ngāpuri. So before the missionary arrived, there were slaves all up there. Slaves are disenfranchised people. They're outcasts. So who do they latch onto? The missionaries. So those slaves became some of the first early converts because they were disenfranchised, and the missionaries welcomed them in. So when the gospel eventually seeded within Ngāpuhi, they began to release their slaves back because they were like, oh, actually, we shouldn't be doing this anymore. You know, so they begin to release their slaves to go back to their homes. Yeah. Oh, sorry, sir. There was one.
I had the same sort of thing about 15 years ago, and one of the discussions that we had, the emphasis you put on the urgency of signing in Russell at the time, hopefully there was a lot of French, and there was a French media motive coming out, and it was Catholicism that we were trying, was really urgent. With the subsequent land grabs later on, the church actually owns a lot of land throughout the country,
yeah.
And it's on lease now from the church to 100-year leases and things like that. How much responsibility should the church take, Church of England and Catholic, whatever, in an apology as well?
I actually believe that's quite big. I think that's quite a big deal. The issue really is the land. Chiefs would begin to say around the late 1840s that, man, you kept bringing one plow for heaven, telling us about this God. Meanwhile, you plowed the land and took it away from us. In other words, the truth is that our Christian gospel over the last 200 years has this predominant emphasis has been the heaven. In other words, if you take the equation of heaven and hell out of the gospel, why would we preach it? That's been the dominant focus about something that happens after the end of your life. Māori saw through that. They're like, what? But I'm living here. Like, this is where I live. Like, this is what's important right now, what does your story about Jesus say to my right now? And obviously there's clear examples of how the gospel totally brought reformation to Māori society. Cannibalism and infanticide stopped, all this sort of stuff. But when you take away that land stuff, then you've got, there's some big things. So I think the church, particularly our tuakana, our big brothers in the faith, what's interesting, though, is that the Catholics and the Anglicans in particular have carried this story more than anyone in any part of the church. So in a way they know, and also in the way they don't know as well. So I don't have an answer, but I myself have the question. I think it's a question. And we can only actually see what the Holy Spirit does with it over the next generation. Yeah. So.
I'd be a typical white middle class guy who was pastoring on the North Shore in Auckland in the 90s. And so when all the Treaty of Waitangi stuff came out, probably my thinking was typical of white middle class, and it wasn't always complimentary. I think, unfortunately, we weren't really taught much about land issues. I went to the Solomon Islands, and I learnt more, probably had a better understanding of what the land meant to the Māori than I did living on the North Shore, because there I was cut off from my sources and had to live with the Solomon Island people. And I guess, and think like you today, it opens up your mind to thinking beyond my world. And I appreciate what you've said because it's given me a view outside my worldview, because I am white, middle class. I passed it on the North Shore, white, middle class. But when I went there to the Solomon Islands, I found something different. I learnt more about land issues. And I'm sad that I had to go to Solomon Islands to find that out about land. But I appreciate what you've said today. Thank you.
Oh, cheers, mate.
I'm just quite interested in what was your answer back to the 14-year-old? Well, only because as a chaplain in a school where it's predominantly Pacific Island and Māori, in Māmere, you know, and I work with girls, young girls and students, and I do see the parents, and, you know, it's always the... you know, this is our land, and we own this and we own that. And I respect what they're saying, but what you've done today, Ray, is, I mean, Jay, is that you've actually really have widened my understanding and appreciation of the Māori people and the children. But how do you respond to a 14-year-old that would actually say that? Because you wouldn't have told her the whole story, would you?
What?
I mean, you know, how do you respond to that? How do you respond to parents?
Just go on half past two. Do you want me to answer it? Or, hey? You want me to answer it? Okay. So, guys, in the church, we think we have got the ownership and corner on this term called spirituality, and we don't. We have got the corner on a Western worldview, not on spirituality. So the reason I'm talking with this girl is because she sees patu paerehe all the time. So patu paerehe are little fairy people. I ask her, okay, so what do they look like? She goes, oh, they kind of have this pale green eggshell complexion, long red hair. And I'm like, okay. So it lines up to the historical accounts of patu paerehe. And so we talk about these fairy people that have come to her whole entire life. Shall I just end there? Have a great afternoon. No. So we begin to talk about this. And so I just say to her, look, I'll tell you the quick version, is look, the world is made up of spiritual beings, and all of those spiritual beings are made to serve Jesus Christ. They are, no matter who they are or where they've come from, Psalm 82 tells me, and Hebrews 1, they are made to serve Jesus. So I just said, look, here's what we're going to do. We're just going to say to them, hey, you guys, if you serve Jesus, cool. If you don't, you're out of here. You know. But if we're going to pray like that, there's no point praying like that unless you give your life to Jesus. Otherwise, what's the point? You know. So that's where the conversation about the thing came up. And that's where she said, well, I'm Māori. I can't be a Christian. And I go, look, so that's how the typical response is to go, demon, get out of here, you know. Rah! You know, like, whoa, you know, we get all whatever. But I'm like, well, no, if there are spiritual realities, and Māori live in those realities all the time. Like, I can tell you, I can't tell you. I've got stories that I can't tell you because you won't believe me. But the spiritual dynamic within the Māori mind is insane what goes on. This kid's wearing a Chicago Bulls top, Chicago Bulls cap, looks like a typical street kid, you know, a little rug rat. She's seen spiritual beings her entire life, and they talk to her And they've, you know, I just, have they ever hurt you? No. Have they ever asked you to do something you didn't want to do? No. They're just there. She's aware of them. Right? And we, you know, I led her through that process, not freaking out about it, but I just said, here's the deal. All spiritual beings created to serve Jesus Christ. So this is what we're going to do. We command these things to do that. You know, and she gave her life to the Lord, and now she's part of the church of God in heaven now. Yeah, so, yeah, that's pretty cool. So, kia ora, bro.
How important it is to keep our eye on history and know what's gone before, and the power of story and knowing it. Wow. Okay, we're going to do something very different very shortly. So I need you all to get into seven groups.